Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay. Today, we are talking about the original trilogy of Star Wars. So the three original films, A New Hope, released in 1977, written and directed by George Lucas, The Empire Strikes Back, screenplay by Lee Brackett and Lawrence Kasdan, and story by George Lucas, directed by Irvin Kershner, and, of course, Episode 6, Return of the Jedi, released in 1983, screenplay by Lawrence Kasdan and George Lucas. He came back to writing there. We'll talk about that. Story by George Lucas, directed by Richard Marquand. I'm joined by the Lessons from the Screenplay team, writer Trisha Aran.
Hello, everyone.
Writer Brian Bittner.
Hello there.
And editor Alex Cayetos.
Hi.
So this is going to be the first in a trilogy of episodes that we're doing on Star Wars leading up to the release of Episode 9. So this first episode is going to be about the original trilogy, and then we're going to talk about the prequels, and then we're going to talk about the new trilogy. So yeah, so...
Not ambitious at all.
Not ambitious at all.
No.
Trilogies within trilogies.
12, yes. The original trilogy, Star Wars. I feel like I just need to start off by saying... Star Wars is so f***ing good.
I was going to start off by saying that. Oh my God.
I feel like that's just the thing you have to start off by saying.
There you go.
Yeah. It was really interesting for me revisiting these movies recently, and I didn't have time to rewatch all of them. But, and it's that weird thing that happens when I watch Star Wars where it's like there's a record that was recorded the first time my child brain watched Star Wars. And it remembers what it thought at like certain moments. And every time I watched it, it recorded like a new track on that record. And so when I watch it, there's just this like cacophony of different aged young Michaels yelling like what they thought was happening at different moments. And so it's always this kind of like trans, like time travel experience almost watching the originals. But I tried to watch them as new films this time, and it was really like just objectively as films, and it was interesting. And I think watching it in 2:3:5 aspect ratio helps with that. Because I don't know if you guys had this, but because I watched them on VHS for the most part as a kid, I watched the 4:3 version where they cut off the sides.
Ugh.
And so now so now when I watch them in 2:3:5, I'm seeing things that like I've only seen like 7 times as opposed to like 100 times that I saw on VHS. I don't know if you guys have had that experience.
I definitely noticed frames and noticed like really gorgeous framing of shots and symmetry in shots and things that I don't think were really there in the 4:3 versions because they're panning and scanning. They may not be actually centered if the action is taking place on one side of the screen. So I definitely noticed that watching them again.
There's a specific moment where in A New Hope, Luke is looking through his binoculars right at the sand people. And he says like, there's sand people, all right? I can see one of them now. And in the 4:3 version, you couldn't see a sand person. Mm. You just saw the Bantha, but the sides were cut off. So you could, and so then
like
when
Luke's
I saw...
Luke's going crazy.
And then you see it in 2:3:5, and you're like, oh, look, there is a sand person. He's just walking in from the side of the frame.
Well, it's funny because Disney Plus, of all things, is having the same issue, but in the opposite direction with the Simpsons episodes, which were originally in 4:3, of course, and now they're having the like 1.85 like fancy versions, which means like there's a one shot with the Duff factory, Duff beer, and you see Duff dry, Duff light, and Duff, and it's three tanks. In the 4:3 version, you see that there are one tube coming to all three tanks, and it's just the same beer. But in the cropped version, you just see three tanks, and it's like the joke is lost.
So it's actually it's cutting off
The
image. Yeah.
I'm a big proponent of like whatever the original thing was, just always show it that way. Don't ever show me anything
else. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. It is an interesting thought exercise, though, because I was experiencing this as well, trying to go back and watch the original trilogy with your like newest eyes that you can, where you're not tuning out any of it, or you're not like trying to anticipate the lines, or like, you know, skipping to the scenes that you love the most, or wandering in and out to get food or whatever, like, which is, I feel like the more and more familiar you get with a movie, the more you sort of end up doing that. And so I just like planted myself in a chair and I was like, I'm gonna actually pretend that I've never seen these movies before. Of course, I've been watching the despecialized editions, which are just so important. And it is like, it's just so overwhelming to try to regress yourself to that point. Mm-hmm. I mean, you obviously can't. Like, you can't unknow.
Completely do that.
Yeah, exactly. Everything that you know about them now in like the 40 years that have elapsed since then of cinema history, you can't just erase those. But trying to take yourself back to that childlike place of like, what if I had never seen this before? You definitely get that experience. If you've never read the script for A New Hope, like, it's wild. Like, because like nothing in it is explained. Just nothing. It's like the Death Star, a large battle station. Great. Thank you, George Lucas. Sure. What?
The end.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the despecialized versions because that's also what I watched. And I do think there's something really special about being able to, which if anyone doesn't know, like someone went and meticulously recreated the original trilogy, but using high def footage and upscaling things where they could, and basically just sort of pasting together the original trilogy in high def, and it looks great.
Yeah.
But it also doesn't look great because the original trilogy didn't look great. And I think that's kind of...
Well, by today's standards.
Right. But I think that's what's interesting about watching it, like you said, with fresh eyes, is especially watching the despecialized where they didn't fix that issue. And that thing is still, you know, a guy in a wolf mask or whatever.
Yeah.
There is something that makes you kind of giggle at it, but there's also something so charming about it. And you're like, this is just the original movie that was made. This is what people fell in love with. There isn't like a CG Bantha walking down the street because they're like, there can't just be sand there. You know, R2 needs more rocks in front of him. Like, what is all this stuff? You know, Han shoots first. There's no weird like CG dance party in Jabba's palace and all that kind of stuff.
Some of that stuff did not age well.
Right. Yeah. And so I just found it really special to watch those versions sort of warts and all and go, I don't care that this stuff looks goofy. I'm just happy that I'm not watching like 10 different versions shoved together, you know?
Well, I know when I was a child, the first versions I saw were this VHS release. It was like this big deal. And I remember I think it was on the VHS tapes. There was a trailer for this release of the VHS tapes because they wanted you to buy all three. And in that trailer on the VHS tape, it was advertising, this is the like original version of Star Wars one last time. Like that was like, that was actually the tagline.
Wow.
And I didn't think that actually meant anything, but,
sure.
But
prescient.
It really was the last time you could physically purchase this original print of the movie.
Did you have the VHS box set of all three of them?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's the one that we actually still have that one.
And like, I think it's like, there's like a half face on each.
Yes, yeah.
Yoda,
exactly.
Yoda is in the last one. The stormtrooper is in the second one.
Yeah.
I forget who's in the first one.
It's Vader, I think.
Is it Vader?
Yeah.
It's weird because I think my dad was very into like, we're going to rent this movie and then like tape it, or like when it was on TV, tape it. And so my first memories of Star Wars are watching versions that we like taped, and there were like problems in the tapes. And like, that's one of the tracks in my brain that's playing is like, every time C-3PO is coming out of the like tank when he's been given the bath, when, you know, Luke takes him down and stuff, and he says like, actually, there's not much to tell. I remember that the VHS would always like skip and scramble there. And I'm like, my brain still like releases chemicals of like, oh, I hear the line now. Like, right. Like, I can actually hear what he's saying.
It's funny you say that because I'm sure I saw the original trilogy as a kid, but the only one that I had was a taped version of Return of the Jedi. I also, the only Indiana Jones I had was Temple of Doom. So
yikes.
Like, my favorite of those trilogies is the one that I grew up with, even though it's like everyone's least favorite, you know, and not even, I wouldn't argue that they're the best. But also my copy of Return of the Jedi just stopped before the end. So I think it was like after like the blunker,
the final movie.
Hold on, I just said blunker. After the bunker blows up somewhere around there, it's just like, and that's it, you know. So I'm just like, oh, okay, there was Ewoks and then there's no more movie.
Oh my god, that's crazy.
Missing out on the Ewok party is like, all right.
Although it was so nice watching the despecialized to have just
the
regular Ewok party. It doesn't go show me every single planet from the first six movies. It doesn't, Hayden Christensen doesn't show up and say hi.
Oh, I was so relieved not to see Hayden Christensen.
Like, I can deal with most of the special edition stuff. I mean, some of it does look pretty bad. But Hayden Christensen, like, invading my childhood movie.
Yep.
I can't.
Which also just makes no sense if you watch just that trilogy, you know?
Because, like, yeah, he didn't die at that age.
Right.
So, like, why?
You could argue that's when he was last good. That's what he's reverting to, his positive light side.
I'm tired.
Nobody wanted that, George Lucas. Yeah. Nobody asked for that.
Anyway, we're here to talk about how much we love these movies. Yeah. Yay!
Well, yeah, it is interesting because I feel like we can't talk about it without talking about the special edition.
Yeah.
Right.
The first not taped off of TV or not copied version I saw was special edition. Like, I feel like what you had, Alex, of like, oh, the VHS set, the first one I had was the special edition VHS set. And so there's parts of the special edition that are kind of ingrained in me. Like, I was still young enough that I was like, okay, like, this is Star Wars. But there are just some things that really do not hold up.
No.
And like, it's just so frustrating. And I'm not the first person to say that, obviously. Yeah. But revisiting it, it was just like, I feel like if you're going to do the special edition, George, you need to, like, I want you to invest in it, because I don't want to have to watch, like, not only did you put in dumb ass freaking Jabba the Hutt scene in A New Hope where he's talking to Han Solo.
That one hurts me.
It's bad.
So
and
bad.
When they, like, raise Han Solo up to step over his tail. Right.
There's so many things about Star Wars and the special editions and the prequels, and like, I don't want to get into it yet, but just to put the idea out there, I feel like there's so many things that were done that I feel like could look good on paper, that like could make sense on paper, but the way they were done is very, very frustrating.
Speaking of something I think looks great on paper but wasn't done well, stay tuned for our prequels episode.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Well, and I was going to say, I mean, some of the things he did in the special edition really don't bother me that much. Like, there's some stuff, I think, in the Hoth battle scenes where he just cleaned up, you know, there were some artifacts that got cleaned up. You know, like,
right.
Like, if you want to do that to your movie, like, clean up the effects a little bit.
Fine.
Like, great. It's almost like doing, like, a cleaning up an old film print.
Yeah.
But
even the, like, set extensions are best on the... And the Cloud City, I feel
right. Most of the Empire Strikes Back stuff actually works for me. Mm-hmm. But it's
the least messy of the
special. But when you're on Tatooine and like there's this awkward shot of just like reptilian skin taking up the entire frame for like 30 seconds in like the wrong size to ratio with the stormtroopers walking by in the background, like that didn't help this scene. That didn't do anything. That just took me out of it.
So as I was watching A New Hope again, one thought I was having was, first of all, Obi-Wan has like every line of his is like the most badass line.
Yeah, of course
ever.
It is. Yeah,
like,
of course it
is. Everything he says is like a classic like line.
Yes.
It's just so amazing.
Yeah. And like it is, his delivery is just incredible.
And like stretch out with your feelings and like that's no moon. It's just, like just everything. But one of them is before they go into Mos Eisley, he's like, you'll never find a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. Cut to special edition, like goofy CGI, like shenanigans happening. Yeah. And like, that just directly opposes the whole weight that was just built up by this amazing line from Alec Guinness.
Right.
Very frustrating. But anyway, these movies are amazing.
Are amazing.
Yes, well, they are.
Yeah. Talking about a thought with New Hope, and especially talking about, forget all the effects, forget the special editions, especially watching the despecialized. Like, I was watching New Hope just going, every frame of this movie looks like it's from another world.
Yes.
Like, no, you know, there's nothing that looks familiar. Everything, there's so much attention to detail in every, the costume and the set design and everything. And I just thought it, we talked about that with Blade Runner. We kind of touched on it with Alien, like the
used future.
Right. Well, not just the used future, but all the camera's doing is looking at this wall. And I just want to look at this wall for 10 minutes because it looks beautiful.
Well, the ambition of this movie.
Right.
Just
insane.
Is so amazing. Like,
yes.
Like this movie, nobody expected it. Nobody expected George Lucas to make a new classic. It was just kind of thought of as like a B movie, right? When they were making it. And it's just like the ambition, he went so far beyond what was expected.
Well, and this is the thing that makes me want to cry every time I watch it and every time I read about it, which is just, it was this underdog of a film. And it was like, opened on like 32 theaters or something on a Wednesday. And they were like, it can't go up against anything. It's not even like the main release that the studio is doing this like particular weekend. And it was like George Lucas underestimated it so completely as well. Like, everyone just so underestimated it, and they couldn't have anticipated how meaningful it would be, in spite of the fact that it is this old as time, just like legend, archetypal story. It was like the 70s were all just like, look at all these serious movies that we're making. We're making all these war dramas, and we're making all of this, like, you know, these like super quiet, like ordinary people. Like,
which are great movies.
No, no, sure. I'm not throwing shade. I'm just saying that was the environment in which this movie came out. And then, you know, you have these stories and they're legends or whatever. They're just sort of part of the mythology of it by this point, of like George Lucas, like, was in Hollywood out to lunch on the day that this movie came out, or the weekend it came out or something. And he like ran into a line of people standing on the block, and he's like, what the hell are you guys here to see? And they were like, Star Wars.
That's one of my favorite stories that my parents would tell me as a kid, was like, they were driving around in San Francisco one day, saw a bunch of people in a line around the corner from this theater. Yes, and they were like, what is this? I don't know. Let's go stand in line and see what it is. And then they saw Star Wars.
Does it not make you want to cry, though? It's so amazing.
Yeah.
I just love that life philosophy. Hey, line, let's go stand in and see what happens.
The 70s, man.
Yeah. 70s in San Francisco.
One of the best little stories that, so I've recently, not recently, but I have a book coming out next year, and I'll keep you guys posted on that. But it's about the women Air Force service pilots of World War II. Who were fighting for their, like, they served in World War II, but they weren't militarized until the 70s. So their battle to be militarized was happening in the 70s. And a lot of it, you know, was like waging in Congress. And they were collecting signatures for their petition to be militarized, these women. And there was a woman in San Francisco who was like, this block is full of people. And so she just got out and she started like petitioning, and the people there to see Star Wars were like signing the petition, and they helped like the women Air Force service pilots get militarized in Congress. What the hell?
Like, that's a fun connection.
Yeah. Just like, so specific.
The ripple effect of what this movie meant in cinema history is just impossible to calculate. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. And that is like what the magic of it is. It's wrapped up in how undersold it was. It's that the movie itself feels like it is Luke personified. It's like this farm boy from Tatooine who shouldn't be anything and shouldn't be a Jedi and whatever. It's, I mean, really American if you want to like drill it down that way. But it's part of the reason why they're as beloved as they are. It's like the mythos of it on a meta level echoes what these movies are. It's incredible.
And you have some things that just weren't sort of being done at the time. You have the very simple, the hero's journey.
Yeah,
you know?
You do.
And it's like, as soon as Star Wars came out, every exec in Hollywood was like, get me Joseph Campbell, you know, like we have to, and then like, just make movies like this. And then like people did, and they're like, oh, but they still have to be good movies. You can't just say, here are some plot points. That's like, okay, George Lucas read a book about storytelling and went with it, like, fine, like that's just being an educated storyteller. And then there's something like the lightsaber, which is just like, oh, you invented kind of
so cool
coolest thing ever.
Michael, tell us about how you feel about lightsabers.
I can't, there are no words.
Actually, there are very specific words, and this is another thing that I think is so incredibly genius about these movies. You were talking about how they look like every frame of them is from another world, but they don't actually. Like, they look like Earth. They're accessible, you know.
Sure,
like,
it's familiar,
so think about like Endor. It's a redwood forest. It looks like a redwood forest. It has gravity, and like they're walking around speaking English, and why would they be? Of course they wouldn't be. Why is, you know, as famously asked, why is everybody on the Death Star British? Like, there's no Great Britain. The language of the invented sort of terminology of things, like even the word lightsaber, is just so elegant in its simplicity. Like, you're pairing two words that we are familiar with, and like land speeder, Death Star. We understand what these things are.
Monkey lizard. Salacious Crumb shout out, sorry.
I'm never going to be rid of Salacious Crumb. It's the scourge of my life.
Although, you know what has always kind of like confused me or puzzled me a little bit? There's the Death Star, but then there's also the Star Destroyers. And the Star Destroyers aren't nearly as powerful as the Death Star, but they're called Star Destroyers. I'm just saying.
Maybe it's easier to blow up a star because it's already like hot.
I mean, you have to just imagine like whoever is, you know, the Empire people just being like, well, this sounds cool,
right?
Yeah,
sure.
They named it before
that badass name.
Yeah, that's fine.
So I just want to like shout out that there's so many things as a filmmaker that like all three of these movies are so formative for me as far as just
yes
my idea of like what I want a space battle to be, what I want a chase scene to be, like the speeder chase in the Redwood Forest. I rewatched that today. It's really stellar. I mean, like,
it's so
it's
fun.
Amazing.
Like, the effects aren't perfect anymore. You can tell that they're all green screen, but like the sound design, it just
really
there's no
cool.
music, just incredible sound design, and it like the sound cuts on the visual cuts. It's like so elegant and crisp and kinetic and insane. The Death Star trench run, I feel like, is just still like. I mean, and same thing with the sound design and that, the sound of the TIE fighters where just you cut to the TIE fighters. It's incredibly loud screaming.
And it's the coolest
away.
Sound ever.
It's the coolest. Yeah. Cut away. And it cuts. And you're like, it's such an elegant, awesomely designed idea of like space combat. And I still don't really see much of it.
Well,
like,
won an Oscar for sound and for visual
yeah.
effects. Like they all three won Oscars for sound, didn't they? Like
probably.
Yeah.
I'm sure. I feel like we need to name drop Ben Burtt.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We really do.
My God.
Yeah. The soundscape is unreal.
Right.
Like just brilliantly envisioned and all of it mixed and
yeah.
all of
and
it.
Also the
flawless.
The battle sequence, all of them, I think about any battle sequence or action sequence from those movies, you know exactly what's going on, you
yes.
know?
Yes. There's coherence.
Right. Hoth or the speeder chase. Like, I know how many people are here. I know what needs to happen in order. They have to get the thing around the legs and then they fall down. You know, it's like, oh, the speeder, there's two. And then now there's two more and you have to fall. And I just think that like, so many battle sequences these days. There's so much cutting, so much back and forth. You're like, I'm just watching people get decapitated and I have no idea what's going
right.
on.
Right.
Right. No, there's an elegance, like we said earlier, there's an elegance to everything in these movies that actually it provides a more thrilling experience than something that is noisy and messy and bouncy and confusing. Because then there's a tune out that happens when you just literally cannot tell what is happening.
Well, these movies are called a space opera. Mm-hmm. And I think the word opera is really perfect here because, you know, in classic opera, they're often in like the second act or third movement or whatever. There's like a ballet, like they sort of like stop the action of the opera. And then there's like a ballet part to it. I feel like this borrows from that where there's like, now here's the ballet of this like dogfight, this incredible thing that's happening out in space. And the same thing with the speeder chase, like on Endor, the forest moon of Endor. Does anyone know what's on Endor?
More Ewoks. An Ewok factory.
Yeah. All right. I mean, someone who's read the books, I'm sure, can tell me. But there is this really clever, I don't know, sequencing of these things where there are these building blocks. And no, none of these three movies have the same building blocks twice, but they all feel related. They're all a part of the same puzzle. And so, yeah, I was really admiring when I was rewatching Empire Strikes Back, all of that dogfighting and like the obviously Hoth is an amazing opening sequence and all of that stuff. It's so different from everything that we saw. Nothing that we saw in A New Hope looks anything like that battle on Hoth, looks anything like, you know, the climax of that film. And yet, there's no question that they are so closely related. It's just a brilliant step forward and like creative reimagining of like what else is possible in this universe or what else is likely to happen in this universe. I love it. It's great, great writing.
That really struck me rewatching it again, just the coherence of the universe.
Yes.
And yet not just repeating the exact same structure or formula from the previous movie.
Right, because A New Hope is such a simple story. You know, like there's the old, like it's almost a Mad Lib of a young orphan named, and you cut out Luke Skywalker and put in Harry Potter. You know,
right.
It does it. And then you cut out Vader and put Voldemort. It's like the entire story of Star Wars is also the entire story of Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter and blah, blah, blah. And then Empire Strikes Back and to a lesser extent, Return of the Jedi, but especially Empire. It just is this very elegant other thing where they're like, everything you maybe expect is not quite going to happen, but it's also going to happen bigger. There's going to be some like romance that wasn't there before. There's going to be some philosophy. Like we're going to get kind of dark and weird for a little bit, but then the action's going to get bigger. And I feel like, not to get into Last Jedi yet, but like Last Jedi tried to be a lot of things, but it was very disjointed. And Empire is a lot of things that flow very neatly together, you know?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I might argue, I was thinking about this time when I was watching it, is the Millennium Falcon the protagonist of The Empire Strikes Back?
I mean, it has an arc because it goes from never working.
That's what I'm saying. Well, it's so funny because everyone is talking trash about the Millennium Falcon in the first movie, and yet it performs perfectly, and it is like a great ship and is like amazing, and everyone's like, you came here in that? You're braver than I thought. And it's like, there's no cause for that. They took all of that trash talking.
Right.
They made it the entire plot of The Empire Strikes Back.
All right, get ready for this.
How many times does it fail in Empire Strikes Back?
At least three.
Four?
Three or four, yeah.
I love Carrie Fisher's performance the last time it fails. Mm-hmm. She just like sits down in the chair and just like puts her hand in her head.
Yep.
Her head in her hand. Just
The thing with Empire though is, so I'm kind of going to rewind to Child Michael.
Yeah.
And Child Michael, the way he enjoyed these three movies was Return of the Jedi first, and then the original Star Wars, and then Empire last, because it had the most talking, and the opening on Hoth was like, I don't want like terrestrial snow in my Star Wars. I want a space battle if I'm watching Star Wars. So like,
why are they fighting on the ground?
the asteroid stuff is pretty great.
Right. Like eventually it gets, but I would remember as a kid, like wanting to fast forward through parts of it.
Right.
And so it's this weird, I feel like this maturing that happens where I feel like you have to have a certain level of maturity to appreciate what is so amazing about The Empire Strikes Back.
Right.
And I can imagine being, you know, seeing the original Star Wars and then going, oh, they're going to make a second one. We're going to do it again. And then watching The Empire Strikes Back and feeling very frustrated. Because I feel
this is very different.
Yeah. And it ends like completely on a cliffhanger and it splits up the characters that we've known and loved. I think it pulls it off amazingly. And again, I think we should talk about this more when we get to Last Jedi time. But I do think that is an interesting, like, there was a moment in time when all that existed was A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi hadn't been there, hadn't come out yet. And I wonder, like, it would just be so interesting to really sit with that and time travel and be in that time period. How would you feel coming out of Empire Strikes Back? But you also get like Darth Vader's his father. So like, I don't know.
And also, the best thing. There's so much that we take for granted in the Star Wars universe that is introduced in Empire Strikes Back. Even the Imperial March does not appear until Empire Strikes Back, which blows my mind.
Wait, right. What?
The Imperial March theme is not in the original Star Wars in A New Hope.
Oh my God.
It's introduced in Empire. Yeah.
John Williams!
Yeah,
it's so amazing. Yeah.
Every time Vader shows up in the first movie, it's just like jaunty Irish music. It's weird.
Well, also,
oh my God,
rewatching Empire, I did, and this is also probably the change in directors and just some change in creative control or who was making the decisions. But
you mean George Lucas didn't make it?
Hey now, hey.
Listen, I'm not going to trash talk George Lucas about the original trilogy. We can save that for later. But I noticed like there was already kind of like a maturity in some of the just the way the shots were framed in some of the early scenes on Hoth. Just really nice framing where you have, you know, five characters in one frame. There's some depth in the frame. There's C-3PO in the background, but he's kind of involved in the scene. In the foreground is Leia. You know, it's like, oh, this is more like a classic just movie. Like this is really well shot and executed in a way that's not just sci-fi genre, you know, action.
Which again, I think you don't appreciate in the 4:3 version either. Like I think seeing it in its full widescreen where you can appreciate, oh, this is what this shot is and this is what it means.
And as a kid who's just waiting for like the next base battle, you're not appreciating.
Right. Yeah. For sure.
I mean, rewatching it, the whole thing, the first movie feels very Shakespearean almost, where we spend like a ton of time with these two droids. Like, yeah. It feels like, which I know is having to do with the editing, you know, because there were all of these scenes with Luke earlier that were in the script that they did shoot. And then they just were like, this is not working out. It's too much exposition and stuff. And it's too many storylines also, because you are following Leia and what's happening with her and Vader and all of that stuff. And it's like really political. And they're like talking about the Empire, and they're talking about the Emperor, da, 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 and like the rebellion. That stuff would totally be difficult to follow if you were also trying to like get on board with Luke too early. But the idea of focusing on these two droids almost as these like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern kind of like.
Right. I wanted to like name check, you know, a lot of Shakespeare plays open with two true random characters. And I couldn't name check them because I don't remember who they are. It's like Fernando and Barnaby, and they're just like having a chat.
C-3PO and R2-D2 is who they are.
Yeah, exactly.
And it is like a really bold choice also, because one of them only speaks in bleeps and bloops. Like, it's just really confident filmmaking for somebody who was still so new as a filmmaker.
Well, it's so funny. Yeah, I don't know if we can call it confident.
For sure, because like, it was in like, the edit, of
right,
course. Yeah.
I feel like the part of the mythos of Star Wars is like, I think it was his ex-wife, right? Lucas's
Maria,
ex-wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of came in and was like, I'm going to change some edits around and now your movie's good. And like, good call getting John Williams, because here's the music that's going to make everything.
Right, right.
Like, it's a good thing Ben Burtt was on board. So like, there was a lot of like,
kind of a mirror.
He got saved many times.
Yeah.
But it is interesting structurally that, it's 17 minutes before we meet Luke Skywalker in the first movie.
Although it's funny because I saw, in as I've mentioned many times, I've been going to a bunch of Kurosawa films, and The Hidden Fortress is the one Lucas cites. And it's the kind of movie where you watch it, you're not going to go, oh, of course that leads to Star Wars. But when you watch it knowing that it inspired him, first of all, it was Kurosawa's first widescreen film, I think. So appropriately enough, you know, for the conversation. But then you do open with these two just sort of like common folk, you know, and then they are main characters throughout the movie, but they're not like the main people in the movie. And you're just sort of following, you're seeing the world through their eyes.
Right.
And then even as... I think it's Toshiro Mifune, even as he's introduced, he's still introduced as like the guy who's sort of following them around, and he's there, but he's like not even, you're not even focusing on him.
Wasn't he supposed to play a character in A New Hope, or that Lucas wanted him to play a character in A New Hope?
I don't know.
Yeah, I have this written, I have all of this written down somewhere, because I did a bunch of like a deep dive into the making of it. But yeah, like that level of influence.
Right.
Absolutely there.
Watching it again, C-3PO and R2-D2, they're... chemistry and their humor and their
amazing
dynamic right from the beginning of the movie, really, it really invites you in. You know, it's not an alienating movie in the sense that you're presented this kind of strange alien world where everybody kind of talks differently, or maybe it could be a kind of a just like overwhelm with like, what am I looking at? But it's just so relatable to watch these two characters and their dynamic, and just it's genuinely funny. Like, C-3PO's dialogue with R2-D2 is genuinely good writing.
It's also that fun device of like, you don't hear what one character says, you just hear the response.
Right. Yeah. Which also pulls you in, you know, because you're filling in the blanks and you're kind of making up what R2-D2 said, and it's maybe better than what could have been written.
And I'm so glad they went with Anthony Daniels' performance, because they had other actors trying to voice C-3PO, and they were trying other people's performances, and eventually they're just like, let him do it. Like, he's walking around in the character and everything like that. And I do wonder if part of it is because we can tell that there's like real people inside these, and same thing with like Chewbacca, like we understand Vader, like, you know, not that they would do a robot for Vader, but you know, they're like, you're 7.5 feet tall, Peter Mayhew, the part is yours.
For Chewbacca,
yeah,
for Vader it's weird, because I feel like David Prowse as like the bodybuilder is not like, you can, when you've seen this Star Wars as many times as I have, you see that he is not like an actor. So every once in a while you have James
Especially
Earl Jones.
Especially the first movie.
Totally,
right,
yeah.
You have James Earl Jones saying something like really deep and profound and terrifying. And then you have David Prowse sort of like just like putting his finger up or something like that. And it's like, that's not quite meh. And that's so nitpicky that I'm not going to ever, you know, dwell
on. The one part that always makes me chuckle is when he's talking out loud about, I haven't felt a presence since...
And then he turns.
He just like turns very abruptly and walks off.
He turns and the other guy's right in his face.
Yeah. It just doesn't feel right. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I was noticing is the tone of A New Hope is unlike like any movie ever, I guess, maybe. Where like you were saying, Alex, like that there are these two droids and they're like funny and it's kind of like fun. But also it's like super like dark, and when the Darth Vader first appears, he's very menacing, and like the Empire is like like actually listening to what they're talking about and like what Tarkin's like thing is, like they're, it's really dark and messed up. Like he's gonna, they want Princess Leia to talk. Darth Vader's like, well, we have a mind probe. It'll take a while, but like we can do it. And he's like, nah, let's go blow up an entire planet just to make her talk. And then we're going to kill her right afterwards. And it's, like, that's a really heavy thing.
We also see like fleshy skeleton burnt bodies in this movie.
Oh, of his parents?
Like bloody skeletons.
It's like very graphic depiction of the death of Uncle Owen and Aunt Peru.
You can also see how distraught Leia was because she's, you know, it makes her British for a little while. I recognize your foul stance and fertile brought on ball.
Well, what you're saying actually, and I wrote this quote down because I think it is so salient is the word I'm looking for in terms of the appeal of Star Wars. And it's Roger Ebert, of course. And he says this, what makes the Star Wars experience unique though, is that it happens on such an innocent and often funny level. It's usually violence that draws me so deeply into a movie. Violence ranging from psychological torment to the mindless crunch of a shark's jaws. Maybe movies that scare us find the most direct route into our imaginations. But there's hardly any violence at all in Star Wars. Even then, it's presented as an essentially bloodless swashbuckling. Instead, there's entertainment so direct and simple that all of the complications of the modern movie seem to vaporize. Mm-hmm. But it is. It's dark. It's violent. It feels like those stakes are real. And yet it is still so entertaining that it doesn't, for lack of a better term, bum you out, right? Mm-hmm. It is able to, like, feel human without feeling like this weighty drama that has to dwell in the violence, which is just, again, this like swashbuckling thing that's like honestly from like the serials like Flash Gordon and like those like 30s like Robin Hood kind of like Errol Flynn things. That's how it feels. It works so well.
It's funny because there's I was just learning about this sort of idea that there are two different ways that we take in entertainment. Mm. And there's the hedonic or like sort of hedonistic side of just being entertained and having fun. And then there's the udonic, which is
umami.
I'll get there. Umami. Yeah. Salmon skin roll. And then that's the sort of like, I appreciate this, you know? And I think that like we've talked about like a movie like Prometheus where you're just like, I don't care if there's like all sorts of hidden stuff in the wallpaper. Like if I wasn't entertained, it doesn't matter, you know? Mm. And you have other movies that are very entertaining and then you never want to watch them again because you're just like, who cares? Whatever, you know? And I think that's one thing that is sort of Star Wars has, especially the original trilogy and especially even the first movie, just sort of nailed was that sort of like, I appreciate what's being said here and there are ideas and there are interesting lines and there's so many little details I can appreciate, but I'm just having fun, you know? And I think that like, I remember, again, we'll talk about this in a future episode, but walking out of Rogue One, just being like, the movie just wasn't fun. Like, regardless of how you think, whether or not you think it was a good movie or you liked the movie or whatever, like, I didn't just...
I kind of like Rogue One.
And I'm not going to, like,
I'm
argue...
I'm a Rogue One apologist.
I'm not going to say anything... I'm not going to say anything about Rogue One other than I walked out of it feeling like it was less fun than I expect to have.
Sure.
You know?
Speaking of just, like, having fun. So, it's interesting because I remember as I grew older and I learned that apparently Return of the Jedi is, like, the least liked of these movies. Right. And I still have a very fond place in my heart for Return of the Jedi. I love it. I am here to defend Return of the Jedi.
You just love Ewoks.
I don't mind Ewoks. What's wrong with Ewoks?
I don't hate Ewoks either.
I think they are perfectly fine in the Star Wars universe.
I agree. I think what struck me this time watching the first 30 minutes of the movie was like, oh, it's actually campy before you even get to Ewoks.
Oh,
like,
it's so campy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And don't get me wrong. I love Return of the Jedi, as I said earlier. But like, I'm just like, oh, there's a lot of like, first of all, there's like a lot of puppets, you know?
I mean, so many. The pig guards are pretty goofy looking.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Like, they're straight Muppets.
Bebop
like,
and Rocksteady, yeah.
Right.
But then the Ewoks, I think, yeah, they're like cutesy and like maybe not congruent with stuff from the first two movies. But also like, yeah, they're going to eat them and like they're weird and sort of like,
I mean, there are Jawas in the first movie make cute sounds
who are goofy,
but they're not teddy bears.
You can't even see their faces.
I feel like what I did feel this time watching, I kind of skipped through Empire and Return of the Jedi for time reasons, but you can feel, maybe this is projection, but I could feel the toys. So in Empire, what are some more cool toys? And I feel like Return of the Jedi just went so hard on the toys. And I feel like that started to supersede kind of the plot and the movie in a lot of
ways.
Right.
Because even like, Jabba's palace is kind of like a showcase of toys.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a reason we know names like Bosk and IG-88 and Bib Fortuna. It's, they
not
were all
everybody
toys.
Knows those.
So. But Star Wars Rancor nerds Beast. Know those. Largely because there were toys made of everything that was in a frame of any movie.
And I absolutely agree with what you're saying, Michael, because it does feel like some of the plot and the character work is getting sacrificed to some of the spectacle, which, of course, is not a surprise when you get to a third film in a franchise that's as lucrative as this one, right? Because, you know, the studio isn't expecting to make its money back on Star Wars. So the fact that they get to sell any toys is kind of just like an added bonus to it.
For Lucas, who had the rights.
Mainly
to the toys.
For Lucas. but it is just like, you absolutely get that sense, especially when you, I don't know if you guys read, I'm sure you have, the deep dive into what was their plan in Return of the Jedi. Like, so how were they actually planning to get Han out of there? Because if you like really, it's like a heist kind of.
Right.
But if you pull it all apart, it makes no damn sense. Like, none of it makes any sense. They like...
When he's frozen in carbonite? Like
Palace. So it's from Jabba's palace.
They send in the droids.
They send in
then
the droids.
Leia comes,
but then, but then Lando Calrissian is in there
he's,
the whole
time. He's already
time.
There.
Like,
yeah.
He's, how did he
he's
get
infiltrated.
In there?
It's like we got everybody
why
in there.
Why doesn't he just get him out of there? Like, it just doesn't make... And if you... Yeah, there's like a deep dive. Someone did like a whole... If the plan had worked perfectly,
what was
it?
The plan? Yeah, this the plan?
Doesn't
did
hold
it work
any
perfectly?
Doesn't hold any water.
You don't see that 3PO, R2, and Lando are all just like slitting throats in the night, and that's what there's.
That's the plan.
R2 would be very efficient at that.
Yeah,
very much so.
Yeah, I feel like there's just something clunkier about the storytelling in Return of the Jedi, and even I feel like as a child, I was watching again the scene today of Luke telling Leia that she's his sister.
Oh man,
and
yeah.
I feel like that. Is like it feels like a soap opera, even the way it's lit and like the staging.
I also feel like Carrie Fisher's makeup in Return of the Jedi, like what happened? Because
I don't know,
it doesn't look that weird in Empire.
It's like, also a soap opera with Han, then later, you know, like,
right?
Because you tell Luke, I don't know,
right? Hold me, like getting foreshadows of Attack of the Clones here a little bit.
Very troubling.
Which, by the way, though, let's talk about Han and Leia's love story in Empire,
right?
Because it's so. Cool. Like, first of all, I love that. Like, when he's like, "Oh, you want me to stay because of the way you feel about me," you know? But
it's wonderful.
I like that. They're just people walking through them, like walking by. It's just sort of like they don't get a quiet moment. They're having this, you know. And then I'm nice men, and I love you. I know. It's just
It reminds me of like a screwball comedy, like classic kind of like snappy dialogue.
Yeah, that's a really good call.
I still can't not think of these movies though as the weirdest love triangle in the galaxy.
Sure. Right.
Because that's how it was set up in the first movie. When you watch it, it's like, this is a love triangle. Like, it's designed to kind of be that way. In the script, when they're about to swing across the thing, Leia's supposed to kiss Luke on the mouth.
Right.
Like, that's the correct response.
Hold on. Well, I would argue. There's an
Empire. Did they know they were going to be siblings in Empire?
No.
I don't think so.
No. Yeah. So, like, it's obviously trying to retrofit this, like, relationship onto that, which I think it works. For the most part, but it still feels like a very weird love triangle.
There's a weirder one. Back to the Future.
Oh, yeah. That is a much weirder one.
Because you kind of don't get the sense that Leia's all that interested in Luke. Whereas Back to the Future, like, she's really into Marty. Like, she's definitely off having thoughts.
By the way, if you show that to, like, modern teens, they get really upset by all of that. It has not aged well. They're like, wait, what?
So weird that like didn't even cross my like.
No, me neither. Yeah.
Wait. She read his underwear.
Empire. One of the things about the way it begins, you know, I was thinking about it, is it's such an interesting way to begin a sequel of like time has passed and like we're not picking up right after. We're not even picking up like a little bit. Like things have happened. And the way it kind of like fills us in about like what has happened, I feel like is so like. Effortless and really fun because again like you're saying there's this the banter between like Han and Leia and so we kind of like I think we it helps us buy the love story because time has passed and we get the sense that this is a thing that's been going on and we're just now kind of getting to jump in
because
on
they moved to Hoth, set up an entire base, like there's a very complex operation that's going on there. There's a lot of earned like the passage of time kind of thing.
Empire does a really nice job of being like, you already have seen all these characters in another movie, but we can't guarantee you've watched that movie. So like, it gives you a really good sense of these people all know each other and there's stuff happening and they're moving. We're like in media res here, or media res, or however you pronounce it. But like, also we're going to let the audience know who these people are and what their relationship is with each other and everything. I think that's really cool.
With continuing action. So like, the inciting incident there is like, Han's going to leave, but Luke gets like locked outside because he gets captured by, tell me what that thing is called.
A Wampa.
Thank you. Luke gets captured by a Wampa. And then like, Han has to stay, but there's that same, like, again, there's continuing choices being made on the part of the characters, like choices. He's trying to leave. She wants him to stay. He wants her to want him to stay. That whole thing. Again, it is continuing a story, but because the characters are making active choices, the character development is also happening in the moment. So it doesn't require us to know. We don't have to know what happened in the years or months or however long it's been since they moved to Hoth. That stuff is not important. What is important is what's happening right now. Because again, the situation is forcing the characters into new choices that are then revealing character.
And that's something I love about the whole feel of those movies. They're always moving. There's always there's a new set piece. There's always, now they're on a different planet. This planet has, it's foresty, it's icy, it's whatever, which has continued onto all of the Star Wars movies, which I think is great. But even in Return of the Jedi, where they're on Tatooine again, they return to Dagobah, there's a second Death Star, which is a weird, you know, choice for the third movie in your franchise.
But it looks really cool because it's half built.
Right. And that's what I mean. Like, all those things that they return to in Return of the Jedi still feel new and interesting. Like, you don't feel like, oh, we're on Tatooine where we were in the first movie. Like, no, we're in like this weird, dirty, you know, corner of Tatooine. Dagobah is similar, but, you know, he's only there for a few minutes.
Yeah. Well, I feel like the other thing in Empire that I was appreciating was just how, like, the design of the pairing of the characters are, like, they're paired with exactly the characters to provide the most conflict.
Yes.
Right.
A classic thing, but it really works, where it's like, you know, Han and Leia have their thing, and they're stuck with C-3PO, who's like the third wheel of, like...
Right.
It's just hilarious. And Luke kind of getting to train with a Jedi master, but it being Yoda, like the last.
Yeah.
Like,
and getting kind of schooled by Yoda. Like, it's not a positive reinforcement a lot of the time. It's like Yoda's kind of chastising him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's always new conflicts that are thrown into relationships once they reach some kind of stasis. So like, think about in Empire, when Han and Leia have kind of like, they've kissed in that, I don't know where they are, somewhere on the Falcon, but like, they've kissed and they kind of talk about how they feel about each other and they're like comfortable and whatever. Throw Lando Calrissian right into the middle of it.
Right.
My.
Who do we have here?
You truly belong with us among the clouds.
Thank
He's
you.
He's so sleazy and beautiful.
He's so good. That's what I mean, is like, the minute that any kind of stasis is reached, they throw something else in. And so like, you know, Vader and Luke, even kind of, Luke is like, he's my father. I have to go like save him. He's not going to hurt me. Da, da, da. Throw the Emperor into there finally, where like, he becomes this person that creates new conflict and forces them to make new decisions. It's just really smart writing.
Well, and I just, I appreciate how like simple all of it is too. Like Luke on Dagobah, it's Luke and it's Yoda and it's R2 and you have his ship. And there's a cave, and like, those are like the only elements basically, and they find ways to make all of it compelling and find new ways of exploring it. And like, there's a meaning to that he crashed into the lake and like, you know, using the forest to raise it up. Like, I just appreciate that they keep it so simple and focused. You can track what is meaningful about the things being done, unless you're like 2-year-old me that does not understand the cave scene whatsoever.
The cave scene broke my child brain.
Yes. I thought Vader was him. Also, in Return of the Jedi, when he cuts off Vader's hands,
yes,
and he looks down at his own black gloved hand, I thought it was like, oh, every, if he kills Vader, he becomes him or whatever.
I have, like,
which metaphorically it kind
of
does.
Yes. This is like so cathartic for me, Brian. Like, I wrote that down, of like, I thought I was the only one that thought that. Like, young Michael did not get metaphor.
Hand hug.
Wait, like wait, hold on. What do you think that like his hand like transferred to Luke's
because,
hand?
Because I hadn't remember it. Like that was the only one I had. So I had.
Oh, right.
If I had seen the first two, I didn't remember them. So I see he cuts off Vader's hand. He looks down at his right hand, which has a black glove on.
Right, right.
And his other one doesn't. And I was like, oh, he like has now magically
transformed.
You know, every part you cut off of Darth Vader is going to appear on your body.
Oh my God. That's like some serious force magic.
Mm-hmm.
It is though really nice screenwriting in terms of like symbols and metaphors, which is what we're talking about. That moment where Luke looks and realizes how he is becoming Vader, right? Like having lost that hand of his to Vader, and then like angry.
That hand is a mechanical hand now, like Vader.
And the shots, right, yeah. The shots where he is like beating Vader essentially with the lightsaber are so upsetting.
Good. Yeah. It's so good.
Mark Hamill's performance in that moment is really scary. It's chilling because up until that point, I kind of don't believe he might turn, right?
Right.
And you absolutely have to believe that in order for any of those scenes with the Emperor to have weight. And when he really starts to get angry at Vader and really goes after him and his face becomes this like mask of rage.
Good.
It's chilling. It's great. Yeah.
Well, and so this is why I'm here for Return of the Jedi, because
okay,
but all of its goofy flaws, all of the bad lighting and makeup and the hold me and all that aside, I have such a thing when a third movie in a trilogy delivers, I am so happy and satisfied, and like there's nothing I love more in the cinematic experience when like the finale of a big huge thing that has been spanning all this time and all this emotion actually lands in a way that like gives
like
me
Avengers Endgame.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I mean, sure. if you're invested in those characters, sure. But like Return of the King for me. Like same thing. Like I loved Return of the King, despite it being kind of weird in some parts and corny and a lot of things I did not like about it, but I forgave it all because it gave me the catharsis I wanted. Like if I get that like big catharsis to this franchise I've invested in, like I forgive a lot. And both the space battle in Return of the Jedi is it's still like my gold standard for a space battle, and I still haven't really seen a better one. Like even the effects, like when they fly into the Death Star 2, right, is
so cool.
The coolest visuals, and it's like so kinetic and so amazing.
Like, I would like to submit for coolest shot ever when they're on their way out, and so it's like pulling back, and then like the stuff comes. I can't even describe.
There's
these repeating geometric patterns the Millennium Falcon is zooming through, and it's just the most kinetic, amazing feeling.
They come into
that.
The foreground, and it's like so. I noticed it this time when I was watching it. I was like, damn, that shot is cool. I mean, everything that the Falcon does is so cool. Yeah. Like the way that it maneuvers. Like I saw the model of the Millennium Falcon in real life at a traveling exhibit once, and it's 4 feet. So, you know, it's got like, obviously the incredible amount of detail that we see, you know, on our screens and everything like that, but just how cleverly envisioned it is and the way that it moves and how unique it is. No other ships in the Star Wars universe look anything like the Falcon. And it's like so cool how it can like go through spaces that are so tight that. And like,
I love how every movie takes advantage of that. You know, in Empire, they're going through those canyons on the the meteor, and the kind of like trench run part two in Return of the Jedi. It's like the exact same thing. And I think also, but yeah, besides the amazing space battle, which I still have yet to see a better one, basically, the emotional catharsis of what we're talking about with Luke, Vader, and the Emperor is just so epic. And so, and I remember like as a child feeling the intensity of those scenes and like the weight of it, and like I think once I'd watched it enough and I was old enough to get like the plot more, the like just great writing of everything's going according to the Emperor's plan, you're all here for like as part of his design. Return of the Jedi gave me everything I want from the finale to a thing.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen many other examples that besides like Return of the King that like really gave that to me the way I wanted.
Well, and I'll add on to that, that I think it kind of set up this, like, the trio finale thing that now, like, every Star Wars movie has to do, basically, but where you're tracking the forest moon battle and the space battle and, like, Luke and Darth Vader, and, like, the intercutting between that, just, like, there's just constant momentum building.
And they're all, like, really well done.
I think that's even true. I was thinking of that with Luke on Dagobah. Like, it's not just, now the movie for 15 minutes is Luke on Dagobah. It's here's a couple minutes and right. then we cut to some other stuff and then we cut back. And I think that like movies need to take advantage of that ability more often than like yeah. if you're going to have a sort of like slow kind of contemplative philosophical luminous beings are we not this crude matter my favorite line in
so
Star Wars.
Good
like then you don't have to just live there for 15 minutes you can sort of come back because I found myself just like the Yoda stuff which is more less actiony I found myself being like oh I forgot we have to cut away now we're gonna come back to it later like I was excited to come back to the most like sedate part of the entire trilogy just because we were cutting away from it. We weren't just like living in that scene for a while. And I think that's really cool.
I mean, and you absolutely have to have it. Like you have to have that counterpoint and be tracking Luke's journey. And like we were talking about how long it takes to meet Luke in the first movie. And then like it does sort of feel a little convenient that he can like, now he hears you know, now he can hear Obi-Wan in his head and he just like trusts the Force. And I'm not criticizing the first Star Wars movie, but I really like want to shout out that choice of spending that amount of time like working on Luke's like development, because then you have to have him if he does not face Vader in A New Hope at all, because he absolutely could not. And if you tried to throw Luke and Vader together in A New Hope and Luke at all came out alive, you'd be like, BS, that doesn't make any sense. We've spent all of this time building up the power of Vader.
Let's bookmark this for the new trilogy episode.
Yeah. Awakens.
Okay, we will.
Right, I was just thinking that.
Exactly, but like you cannot, you would not believe it. And so the way that New Hope like cleverly keeps Luke from confronting Vader, Empire like builds it up and builds it up, and then Luke loses that battle, very much so. Still is not cut out to face Vader. And then you don't buy it until the third one in the series. Wow, it's really, really good in terms of like a 3-movie arc, yeah, which of course no one is promised that they will get. But right. like,
it's good restraint.
Wow.
Instead
yes.
of just skipping ahead to like
yes, yes, yes.
the final right. thing. Yeah.
And it's something I love about the third movie is you have Jedi Luke, you know, mm. like him. Green light. I'm a green lightsaber guy. Like, you know, you've got him just showing up and he's like working his way through the guards at Jabba's palace. And then Jabba's yacht sequence, which is just yeah. still so much fun.
Yeah.
The whole R2 throwing the thing and he jumps off the diving board and, you know, I thought you were blind. Like, it's great.
Well, I think the other thing that I found funny watching it again was how explicit in the end of Empire both Yoda and Obi-Wan are of like, you are not ready. Your training is not done.
Right.
Do yes. not face Darth Vader. And then in yes, Return yes, of the yes. Jedi, he goes back to Yoda as instructed. And Yoda's like, no, you're done. You're done training. And actually, you got to go face Vader. Yeah.
yeah. Also, I'm dead.
yeah. Right. And like, I think there's like, you know, expanded universe stuff of like Luke training himself, I guess, a little bit more between Empire and Return of the Jedi.
But well, the Force is very strong with him. So
yeah, I thought it was very interesting and kind of funny how in Empire, it's like very explicit. Your training is not done and it's very bad to do anything right now until your training is done. And then he's like, your training is done.
Right.
What a bold decision.
Well, it's also
like, I like it. But yeah. I mean, from a writing standpoint, really smart.
It's also conflict. He has to yep. choose whether to save his friends. Like he has a right. strong premonition. His friends will die if he quits his training, unless he quits his training, and he does.
Right.
Like you said, Alex, he has to then face the consequence.
It's a great plot device in Empire Strikes Back, and I'm chuckling at the kind of plot hole of like they yeah. don't explain when he finished his training.
Yeah.
Because right. like now he's ready in Return of the Jedi, but how did he get ready?
Yeah.
through field experience.
Well, sure, and maybe. Even between A New Hope and Empire, he like knows how to do things that he didn't.
It's
know.
True.
Like,
it's true.
In each one, he like levels up and like
what you don't see is him saying, "Well, I'm back. I fought Vader, and all I lost was a hand." And Yoda's like, "Damn. All right. yeah. Guess you're good."
Yeah.
I was just thinking about that.
I'll where, die
like,
now.
That is one of the maybe the only like kind of criticism I have of the trilogy is. Like is that like you're saying, Alex, so much weight is put on like if you go now bad things will happen one way or another, and he goes and basically everything's fine. And I'm now thinking
he
about,
loses a hand
but like they have he gets a new one in like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
it's just as good. But I was thinking about how, you know, Harrison Ford really wanted to die in
Return
of the Jedi. And I feel like that maybe
thus the carbonite would have
made sense arc-wise, where like if to add weight to that choice that Luke makes, like, there does have to be some kind of sacrifice. Like, he isn't able to completely save his friends and save the world and all together.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, while we're talking about three movie arcs, we really need to talk about Leia's for a second, because I feel like if there's one criticism I have of the original trilogy, it's Leia's arc and how lost it gets in everything else. She's such a badass in the first movie, and she's written that way. And of course, Carrie Fisher is amazing from start to finish, and every frame of that, just like, you know, she's like 5'2" and looking up at Vader, and she's like, I don't care, come at me. She's amazing. And like I said, the character is written that way, and she's so fierce and like, and is driving the plot, like her agency in like refusing to give up the rebel base and like all of this stuff from the very top of A New Hope. She has so much to do, like, and she's so important to the plot. You can't have a Star Wars movie. You can't have A New Hope without Leia.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Is that true of Empire? Maybe, maybe not. Is that true of Return of the Jedi?
Definitely not.
Return. Not.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. And it's so like, you actually can, three character arcs, you know, and if, I guess you count Vader's. That's a lot to hold, but it's not impossible. You could have given Leia more to do in Return of the Jedi. You could have given her like, oh, look, she found an Ewok. No, they're friends. Like,
right.
That's, when, which, if, but, which turns out to be inconsequential plot-wise, right?
And like, if there is another, if she is the other Skywalker,
this
like,
is what I'm saying.
Why can't that pay off within the original trilogy a bit more?
Right.
Leia's only one toy, but a bunch of Ewoks, that's a bunch of toys.
This goes back, I mean, I hear exactly what you're talking. I'm not sure that's the entire financial decision.
Not.
But it's like, you could have given Leia something really meaningful to do in Return of the Jedi, and you kind of didn't. All she becomes is like this plot device for Han to do things. Like, Han's going to do a thing because Leia's over there. But that's not enough. Like, you set up this, you created one of the most badass and amazing, like, female characters. I hate to have to say it that way, but like, you set up a princess who actually like is,
gets shit done.
Yeah.
So
is not princessy.
Is not princessy in any way. Like, the minute they show up to rescue her in A New Hope, she's like, you guys suck at rescuing.
Right.
I'll fix
they, like,
this.
They really hate each other actually for quite a bit of New Hope. Like, they're just yelling at each other.
It's great. Again, going back to like throwing characters who are in conflict with each other.
Yeah.
Right? Somebody get this big walking carpet out of my way. Yeah. Yes. You know?
They're really bitchy to each other.
Yeah.
I miss like bitchy Leia. Where is she? Yeah. I want her in Return of the Jedi. And instead we have this like docile
hold
Luke.
Me.
Oh, yeah. Hold me.
Oh my God.
Shoot me.
Although I do like, you know, the callback moment where they get surrounded and then Han sees that she has the gun and he says, I love you. And she says, I know. And then she shoots the guy.
They gave her
they give her some moments.
A moment.
Yeah. And she kills Jabba. Come on. But
okay,
like,
that is true.
But
that
I
is
agree
like
with you about everything
else. But I was thinking about this up until the moment she kills Jabba. She's like so silent. Like,
yeah,
why
right.
is she just like sitting
there? And what
there?
Does she have to wear in order to kill
right,
Jabba?
Of course.
Et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, it's so objectifying that, like, I get it. It's gross. Like, they're trying to make Jabba gross, and he is.
But, like, why would a. And that's a whole other conversation.
But yeah, they give her that moment, and then they let her shoot, like, a thing, a stormtrooper at the end, and that's kind of it. But you could have really fleshed out that storyline and given her a lot to do. And I'm just. I wish a little more from that. And they have, to their credit, tried to make the new trilogy more about
I was
going
to say, I feel like this is a thing that I definitely want to circle back
Let's
to.
Let's circle
when
back
we get
to it for
to
sure. Yeah, exactly.
Because
yeah.
obviously it's unfortunate that whatever their plan was for 9 is not going to
yeah.
happen.
Man.
But
okay. Warning it forever.
Last question I want to ask, just because I'm really curious. Do we like the unmasking of Darth Vader at the
Ooh.
End of Return of the Jedi?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I do. There's a little bit of the logic parts of it where he's like, if I unmask you, you'll die. Well, I'm gonna die anyway. Well, okay then. Like, there's pretty...
That makes sense
big,
to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like pretty quick on Luke's part where he's like, well, if you insist...
I mean, they're gonna blow up.
No, that's true. What bugs you about it, Michael?
I don't know. I guess it's one of those things that I wish I could go back and see them all for the first time and witness my thoughts on revealing Vader, because I feel like I've always known what Vader looks like. In that moment, but I feel like it is. I do remember some memory as a child being so shocked by like, wait, this old man with an egg head with like a crack in the middle is like, that's Darth Vader. But like, it's also this beautiful moment that I really appreciate in a lot of ways. And for somehow it seems removed from the rest of my conception of Vader still. So I don't know. It was just, I was watching it and was struck by it and was just curious.
Well, I think that's why it works so well, is because of the kind of shock of seeing the vulnerability.
Right. There's a human under here.
Of this like kind of frail, weird looking man, you know, like it takes away all of the menace and just makes him kind of like a sad old man. And it's never tainted my experience of Vader in the rest of the trilogy, knowing that that's how it ends. Like I kind of forget about it, you know, and then it's kind of just a beautiful moment when it comes.
I agree with you in the sense that when I first saw it, it seemed to steal something of like Vader's power in a way that I bumped on for sure the first time I saw it when I was who knows how old, very young. But I do think it's a smart choice just objectively, because we have to believe that there really is some, and because of the nature of these films as like a space opera, you kind of just have to like buy some of the stilted, like we said, Shakespearean, like, this is my father. I love him. Like he is whatever, you know, my father before me, I'm a Jedi. You have to kind of buy those theatrics. And I think in that sense, the unmasking of Vader is very operatic and therefore like a very reasonable, good, strong choice. Yeah, I don't know. I personally don't like, Luke, why do you care? This guy has tried to kill you 1,000 times. Sure, he's your father, but he literally has never met you and doesn't even know you have a sister, apparently. What?
Until he reads your mind.
Like, why does he know that he has a son, but he doesn't know that he also has a daughter if they're twins?
Well, there's answers lying in the next episode.
there truly are.
Too many answers. Yeah.
I forgot most of them, but I guess I'll be revisiting them.
I'm just saying, you have to, this formalism of space opera necessitates that choice almost. And in that sense, I think it's the right one. Brian.
So before we wrap up, I got to go to a thing. It was
shocking.
5 years ago.
Oh.
Jason Reitman used to do these staged readings of screenplays with actors who were friends of his and stuff. So I was the Ace Hotel in downtown LA, and it was the original script of The Empire Strikes Back, which you talk about the sort of operatics and floweriness and all that kind of stuff. It was wow. Like there are moments where you're like, yikes.
Not leave you behind.
Yes. But the cast was Jason Reitman as narrator and R2-D2, Kevin Pollak as Yoda, Stephen Merchant as 3PO.
Yes! Oh my
God. Dennis Haysbert of Allstate fame as Lando.
Yes, I love Dennis Haysbert.
Jessica Alba as Leia.
Okay.
And Ellen Page as Han Solo.
Oh yes. My God.
That's awesome. That's
Aaron so Paul cool. as Luke.
Perfect.
Nice.
And then J.K. Simmons as Vader.
Yes.
Like, dude. This was like a few days after he won an Oscar.
Dude.
And he comes walking from the back of the theater surrounded by stormtroopers and he's in all black.
I cannot.
And that was the only cast announced. Then there were two surprises. One was just a ridiculous surprise, which was Rainn Wilson as Chewbacca.
Sure, sure, sure.
Nice, nice.
Who literally just showed up to go, ah.
That's great.
He didn't even try to do the noise. He just kind of yelled every time Chewbacca said anything. And then as Obi-Wan, the Emperor, and Boba Fett, Mark Hamill walked out.
Damn. Oh, nice. Of course.
And I lost my mind. I was the third row center. Like I was like really close. And I lost my mind.
Nerdgasm.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Fantastic.
Were you crying? I'm crying listening to
I think
to
I
this.
Cried just when Mark Hamill walked out.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
I was
yeah.
just not expecting it after
incredible.
That.
Incredible. Yeah. Wait, so do you have anything, like, I know we're trying to get like closer to the end here, but what did you take away from the original draft of Empire that you didn't get from the movie?
Just that there was some writing that was silly. Like, I wish I could remember some of the lines and stuff, but it was like the entire room was just going, okay. And it was just stage direct. It wasn't even, you know, it was just like a sparkle in Yoda's eye tells Luke that it's, you know, whatever, just some ridiculous stuff.
Nice.
That's awesome. The closest Star Wars fame encounter I had was that Carrie Fisher asked me to hold her Coca-Cola once.
Wow.
And that was really exciting.
Did you melt into a
Wait,
bottle?
Hold on. Coca-Cola.
It was a Diet Coke. Technically, I don't know. I just want to paint a picture. It's a Coca-Cola.
I was like, was it the 1950s?
I know. All right. Why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take from the original trilogy of Star Wars.
Everything?
Yikes and a half.
Brian, oh, God. Kick us off?
I mean, it's such a, like, everything we spoke about, but there is this sort of sense of, like, finding something to latch onto that's fairly simple and then just sort of, like, going everywhere with it, but never straying too far from that point. And I really want to talk about Last Jedi, because I think that it's like the original trilogy, arguably not every scene or every moment, but like it does a really good job of being like, here's this thread of what Star Wars is, and we're never going to go too far from that. But we're also not going to get comfortable. We're not just like, now we're going back to Tatooine to check in on whatever. It's like, no, we're off now. We're like off on this three film thing where we're never getting comfortable again. We're going to have moments of quiet and moments of crazy and all points in between, but we're moving from point A to point B, and like, and we're sort of always staying true more or less to this singular thing that we are doing. And I don't know how that's a lesson. I don't know what you do with that, but like
it makes sense. There's a boundedness to the world, and yet you're not keeping it too narrow. It's like it's a really fine line. Like, how do you expand the universe with each film without jumping the shark? And like, how do you know when you're jumping the shark if you're making up the universe?
But, it splits the characters up in a really clever way. Like, think about the way that, you know, they're all in one place. This goes back to like what you're talking about, not getting comfortable. They're all on Hoth. The minute that they're all like, we're all on Hoth, Han's like, I'm leaving. Luke's like, I'm going to get captured by this abominable snowman. The Empire's like, we're going to come in and smash this whole thing up. There's no point in which there is like, a home for the characters. And so by forcing these characters to be nomadic, you have something incredibly dynamic where they are then sort of always out on an adventure. They are never brought back to like any sort of homestead or hearth or, you know, those kinds of like ideological locations. It's, I mean, you can't do it with everything, but in an epic like this, it's good idea. It's smart writing.
Yeah. I thought of this when I was watching, Castle in the Sky, the Miyazaki movie earlier this year. And I was just like, they're like running from people the whole time. And then they're like, they get trapped in a cave and there's a guy there who she knows. So like they're talking to him and then they go somewhere else. And now they're hiding out here. And I was just like, we don't get many like just pure adventure movies these days where it's just people like moving through space and like stopping for like along the way. You know, it just doesn't happen that much anymore.
But I think what I was taking from what you were saying a minute ago, though, Brian, when you kind of very briefly mentioned the new movies in Last Jedi, is I feel like Last Jedi for me went to places that didn't feel anymore like they existed within the same universe as everything else. Like they crossed that imaginary line, which I don't know how you necessarily know what that line is until you cross it. Of course. Of course it's the casino planet. And like the guy in the text playing the dice that the lady told him to go find, whatever.
All right, we'll get come back to that.
Okay, stay tuned.
Anyway, sorry. I just wanted to point out that I feel like the original trilogy somehow it really expands the universe with each movie, and yet you never have that weird feeling of like, oh, wait, we just left.
Right.
We left this universe and went into like a weird other one. Maybe that's because we're just used to the original trilogy, but
There's certainly an element of that.
Yeah.
Well, and I feel like, you know, the lines, if there is a center of all of this and it's A New Hope and a line gets drawn to Empire, that's one line. And then a line to Return of the Jedi, that's, you know, there's only a couple lines. By Last Jedi, we're 12 movies in or whatever, right? So I feel like the lines get harder in the sand, but they're, I don't know.
George Lucas himself in the prequels crossed lines, which I do not think feel like Star Wars.
I feel like the idea of how we create these lines is something I definitely want to explore in our
Trilogy. Yeah. What exactly are the bounds of this bulletin board or whatever? Like, we're willing to put like Tatooine and the Forest Moon of Endor on the same cork board, but we're not willing to put the casino. What is the name of the casino planet?
Brian? It doesn't matter. We're not talking
about it. Canto Bight.
Canto Bight. Thank you. We're not willing to put Canto Bight on that same bulletin board. Anyway.
Yeah.
But actually, my lesson is related to the one that you were talking about, which, so this, and I feel like I say the word archetype and archetypal quite a lot on this podcast. George Lucas sat down and read Joseph Campbell's Heroes with a Thousand Faces, which is about like cross-cultural ancient storytelling. Like, what is it that across all cultures, essentially human cultures and recorded history, why do stories take this form, right? Like our most ancient epics, our most ancient, all of these things. We can get into like some of the theories about why, like why is it that, you know, all of these myths sound so similar from like all of these disparate cultures from times and centuries and whatever that is. There's like a lot of psychological and like sociological, all of those ideas about why, but there is something about tapping into this epic storyline that these movies just do really well and really cleanly. Like, you can use this movie, and I have, to teach screenwriting, because the like acts and beats and hero's choices and all of that stuff, they're perfect. And so, like, you know, this is often compared to The Wizard of Oz or things like Lord of the Rings that we've been talking about. It's just really neat and clean. And so it gives all of the, because what, as you were saying, Brian, you can do an infinite number of things with the world if you have this like very clean cut human story. And there is something pure entertainment about it. It almost, but it's still really meaningful. You know, it's Harry Potter. Like, it's almost like the cuts of a key that when you like insert it into the human heart, it like unlocks it. And so that's what Star Wars is. And that's why we're all here.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
My lesson kind of relates to that, but also like, because I'm rereading, or not rereading, I'm reading Harry Potter for the first time. I was definitely catching a lot of those Harry Potter
Welcome.
Things. And in the cantina, when Obi-Wan slices off the guy's arm and it falls on the ground, I was like, the Ministry of Magic is going to be so upset at you, Obi-Wan. Are you allowed to use magic and... these muggles?
Dumbledore would never do that.
Yeah. So my lesson that I'm kind of taking away is just the importance of simplicity. And I feel like that's kind of like what you were getting at also. Is this, if you have this very simple archetypal story that just is solid and makes sense, like, and kind of like what you were saying too, Brian, like, don't stray too far, like, keep it simple, I feel like is the thing that I'm just like really latching on.
You can have a really rich world to support a simple, entertaining story.
Yeah.
With all of these, like, you have the mentor and the gatekeeper and the like friends and allies and the shapeshifter, like all of these, you know, types that we see from like ancient literature, here they are, they work.
And I feel like even like in a scene level or sequence level, like the number of elements at play are relatively small, and they just find interesting ways to create drama with, you know, this room that they've put them in, metaphorically speaking. And so the conflict is coming from the characters and the situation, and not like, well, what if this other thing came in and happened and like messed it all up? Like, I feel like there's very little, you know, deus ex machina, like, we gotta go because now this other thing is happening. Like, there's just really solid character conflict throughout so much of this trilogy, and it's really impressive, I think.
Mm-hmm. Alex?
Alex, you want to take us home?
Yeah, I mean, I think I already kind of mentioned this before, but just from a directorial standpoint, I want more space battles. And and I want space battles to look like these space battles, because especially, I mean, I love the trench run in A New Hope, it's great, but you can see the leaps forward in technology and Empire and then Return of the Jedi, and just the choreography and the framing and the way it's cut, there's such an elegance to just watching these beautiful images in space, and but they're thrilling, you know. And I really don't know if you can like improve upon it that much. Like, we don't need to be like zooming and doing 360 like rotations and like, you know, like there's stuff in the prequels, like in the opening of episode 2, there's like a quote unquote like long take, I think, where
three.
Oh, is that three?
Yeah.
The space battle.
Yeah,
the
opening. Oh, right. Three. Yeah.
Four exclamation points. Oof. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, but just like that wasn't an improvement to me on just the simple, beautiful choreography of the space scenes in Empire and Return of the Jedi. And so I would love to make or see somebody else make just a space movie where we can use the most modern technology to render the images more crisply. But as far as the shot construction and the editing and the way it's just presented to the audience, just do it the way they did it back then. Like that was good and better, and I can follow what's happening and I'm enjoying it and I'm thrilled.
Yeah, so
that's my takeaway.
Yeah. Awesome.
Absolutely.
Cool. Great. Why don't we quickly go around and say what we've been watching recently? Trisha?
So I got to go to an advanced screening of Terrence Malick's new film, A Hidden Life. And I was just really, really overall impressed by it. I have seen every Terrence Malick movie, and I am a huge fan. And so and his last recent couple of films, like Song to Song and Knight of Cups, have been kind of a slog to get through, and they deliver some of the Malick stuff that you want, but then they're also, like, in no uncertain terms, not a movie.
I haven't seen them kind of for that
reason. Yeah, which is like, again, if that's what you're, if you don't mind that from your Malick films, which I would say even like the most quote unquote commercial Malick films are like borderline a movie.
Right.
But if you don't mind totally not a Malick film, I mean, totally not a movie from your Malick films, then you might like those movies. But I really struggled with them. But A Hidden Life actually is a movie in the sense that there is a plot, there are characters, there is conflict, there are discernible acts. Each one of them is an hour long or more, but they do exist. And so for that reason, I was like, this is in a lot of ways a return to form for Malick, where he is telling a story. And it is so unbelievably gorgeous that I just can't even describe what it looks like.
Some of the landscape shots in that setting are just like, what? This is a real place?
So
this
I was weeping by the end of that movie, just very openly and loudly. And everyone in the theater was like very upset by it, I think. But it honestly, the things that made me cry the most were the landscapes, because they would just, you'd have this like intense human drama, and then they would cut to this mountain shrouded in mist with these like in the foothills in the foreground with like waving fields of tall grass and wheat. It's like, what are you doing to me, Terrence Malick? It's just so beautiful. And obviously, like, so I'm a huge fan of nature poetry. And so it is very much treading in that, like all Malick movies are, but this one especially is like the human drama is about nature and the way that the seasons echo like the seasons of life, all of this stuff. It's really incredibly beautiful. It is 3 hours long. So get ready, like get all your snacks and whatever you need before you sit down to watch it. August Diehl and Valerie Pochner are amazing in it. They're the two main characters. My boy Matthias Schoenaerts is in it. I love him so much. He's only in it for like 3 minutes. And I was like, man, I wish there was more of him in it. But and then the score is by James Newton Howard. And,
oh my God, the score. It's like one of James Newton Howard's best.
Easily. Yeah. And he's such, I mean, he's so virtuosic at every moment anyway, but he's incredible in this. And so, yeah, absolutely. Especially if you are into history, and this is a real life story, and the movie sort of like completes the arc of the story of a real person in just this devastatingly beautiful way. Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, last night I saw a early screening of Knives Out, the Rian Johnson movie.
So jealous.
Alex and I went. It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. I really, really enjoyed it. I feel like it was really fun to see where he took himself after all the Last Jedi stuff. And it was like, he said he wrote the script in 6 months and started January 2018, and they were filming and it was done by the end of the year. So it was like this really fast process, but you could tell how much fun they had making it. And it's like a whodunit murder mystery that's like this kind of classic, you know, throwback to whodunits, but also modernized and with a really interesting kind of perspective on it. And it kind of does some interesting things with the genre. And it was just so much, it was just fun. It was just funny. And the cast is amazing. Yeah. And it was just absolutely delightful. And there was a Q&A with him afterwards. And it was, I feel like I vibe with Rian Johnson's energy.
I was with Michael at the screening, and like, Rian Johnson just strikes me as such like a decent, lovely human being. And it just gives me hope of like, oh, wow, like you can be a really nice, lovely person and like be successful in Hollywood. Like that does happen.
One of my good friends interned for him when we were in college, when all he had made was Brick. Mm. And they were working on the Brothers Bloom. And he said he was just wonderful. Basically.
Yeah, his energy just seems so friendly and lovely, and yes. Like I would love to work with him.
Yep,
nice.
Yeah, yeah. So thumbs up, go see it.
Brian.
Let's tie from Star Wars Harrison Ford to he is no longer Jack Ryan, but John Krasinski is now Jack Ryan. Such a smooth. You see
wow,
what I did
yeah,
there?
Whoa. Yeah,
very smooth.
I didn't even notice.
I am not, like, when it comes to sort of like war movies or political movies or whatever, I just find myself like tuning out, and I'm just like, I don't know what this is. First season of Jack Ryan just totally worked for me, and I was like, I like this a lot. I liked Krasinski, but I just liked the story, and I was excited for the second season to finally come out, and it finally did, and I crushed it in a day because of course I did. And I feel like the first episode was just setting up a bunch of this, like, well, we, you know, there's such and such in this country and this president is doing this. And I'm just like, I want to like this, but I just don't know what's going on. And then what they did was, I think the second episode, they made it personal. And I'm like, ooh, now I care about what this protagonist cares about. And I want the thing that he wants for him, you know. And it just made me realize how important that is that, like, even if you don't understand all of this sort of details and minutiae of like what the plot is and something, if you care about a character and what they are after, you're like, cool, I'm on board, you know. And it I really like the way that the season sort of opens up around the second episode, and then you're like, ooh, it just sort of like became this bigger story, and then now there's several different stories and I care about all these several stories. And then of course by the end of the season, then they all kind of drill together and they all come together and everything. And it's just, yeah, I liked it a lot.
Cool. Alex.
So I've been watching Watchmen on HBO, and as of this recording, I'm only 4 episodes in. More will have come out by the time this airs, but and there's so much to talk about with this show, I'm not really going to get into it. I found it very intriguing. I never read the original Watchmen like graphic novels. I just saw like the Zack Snyder movie, which I know is like not the same.
Mm-hmm. It certainly is not
at all.
Yep. No.
What I've really appreciated about this new series is you can tell that, and I've heard him say this in interviews, Damon Lindelof, that he really wanted to take the spirit of the original material and think about what is the political, you know, sociological issues of our time. How would the original Watchmen kind of sensibility approach this?
Yeah.
Let's do that. So it's very fascinating world he's created that is a sequel to the original Watchmen universe, but, you know, time has passed. We're in a different age, and it's an alternate universe and where some things are very different from our world. So the world's already interesting. The thing that is still frustrating for me, because it's Damon Lindelof, and I was a huge Lost fan, and I do like the mystery box thing to some degree, but he really pushes it sometimes where he's like, here's this totally batshit crazy thing, and you're not going to understand at all how it fits into anything else for like maybe most of the season, because I would like to leave you waiting and assume that like the fact that you have like 100 questions is enough to keep you watching a story. And sometimes it's like, just questions don't make me watch a
Maybe
story.
Maybe 2 questions
right.
is enough.
Yeah. But the world he's created, the characters that are in the world, especially as the episodes have gone on, and introducing new characters that are really intriguing, really fun.
Also, Regina King is amazing.
Regina King is amazing, yeah.
Yeah.
The whole cast is amazing. So I'm hooked, I'm in. But I'm just a little bit frustrated. It's just like, you got me, but I'm like a little mad that you got me, because you can't do this, Damon Lindelof. You can't do this all the time.
Do you happen to know who did the music for the show?
Yes, right. I do. The music is stellar.
By
absolutely
stellar. Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross.
Yeah. You don't say.
Yeah. So, of course, I was excited for the show, and I did read the source material. I'd always meant to. I had had a copy, and I just never got around to it. I read it earlier this year, and it's spectacular.
I can't believe I read a graphic novel before all of you guys. What the heck is happening?
I'm a bad geek. But what's cool about the book is it was 12 comic books originally, and each book ends with like little snippets of, oh, it's like a case file or it's a chapter from someone's autobiography. Mm-hmm. So these little other things that exist in the world. And HBO's site has been doing that after every episode. There's like the same little articles and stuff like that. The soundtrack, the score, is being released over 3 volumes. And as of this recording, the first volume has come out. And there's a band in the universe of the new show called Sons of Pale Horse. So the score doesn't say Trent Reznor or Atticus Ross's name once on it. It's just the Sons of Pale Horse album and all the like title tracks from that album, or the tracks from that album. And then inside the album, the liner notes tell the entire history of this band, which also references Nine Inch Nails a little bit, which is like really cute in a way that I'm like, oh, I get this joke. And then like Revolver Magazine posted a review of the album. They're like,
what?
Sons of Pale Horse's reissue still is a mess. It doesn't make up for the fact the original, like, wow. They're going,
it's
so
like committing to an alternate universe.
Wow. Yes, and I love it. It's so much fun to follow along with all this stuff.
Yeah, if you have like the time and inclination for that deep dive stuff, this show, I think,
will reward
has
you.
Built in so many Easter eggs and so many things for that. I just don't really have like the bandwidth for that right now,
right,
in my life. So I'm not going to do that, but it's there. Yeah.
That's
amazing.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you, everyone. This has been our episode on the original trilogy of Star Wars.
I can't believe this is all we get to say about them. We have two more episodes.
Right. Yeah. And I'm sure we'll be dipping back into the original trilogy.
Talk to us on Twitter. We'll talk to you more about Star Wars.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I'll talk to you all day.
Yes. The next episode we release will be on the prequel trilogy. And that's just going to be so much
Let's
fun.
Let's do this.
It's going to be so much fun. So stay
Got
tuned
a bad
for that.
Feeling
and
about
then
this.
The week after, we'll be doing the new trilogy leading up to the release of episode 9. So yeah, look out for those. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to everyone that supports us on Patreon. And we will see you. We will see you in the prequels in the next episode.
See you in prequels.
May the force be with you.